Hello. I'm going to talk to you today about the component of our business that is linking literature to the data in the life sciences. So I'm going to divide the talk into four parts. Firstly, I'll describe exactly what I mean by the literature and also what I mean by the data. And then I'll describe a little bit about how we make literature database connections. And then I hope to show you a compelling case study to illustrate how useful this can be for researchers in the course of their business, making discoveries. And then I'll comment a little bit on some of the challenges and future directions that are relevant. So firstly, what literature am I talking about and what data am I talking about? So in the world of life science data, we have a number of primary databases or deposition databases. And these are, for example, nucleotide sequence databases, databases for gene expression experiments, databases for protein structures. And these databases are populated by the researchers who generate the data, depositing that data in the database, often as part of a funder mandate, and often as part of a journal requirement, actually, for publication. I'm not going to talk about unstructured data sets, which is the topic of many discussions at the moment as to what to do with them and how to archive them, how to access them, and how to refer to them, and how to reuse them. What I'm talking about here is just structured databases, the kind of which we have at the organisation I work for, the European Bioinformatics Institute. The second kind of database that is structured are these what I would call curated databases. For example, Uniprot is an example of this, where the records in that database are derived from the primary deposition databases, but they're enhanced to greater or lesser extent by curators. So this is people, experts usually, in the life sciences in this case, who come along and add content and add references to records that describe proteins. And then, of course, we're linking all these to the literature. So that's what I'm going to talk about. Actually, in the life sciences, we've had quite a long tradition of linking the literature to data resources. Way back in the 1980s, some visionary people realized that the generation of DNA sequence data was becoming more and more common. And in those days, if you sequenced a gene, you would actually write the sequence into your paper. Of course, this becomes a non-scalable solution as the technologies develop and everyone's at it, basically. So they decided to make a database, which was originally called the EMBL Data Library, which was based in Heidelberg, and actually was the seed operation for the institute that I now work at. And the EMBL Data Library did a deal with the editors of Nucleic Acids Research Journal, published by OUP, that anyone submitting papers to that journal would have to cite an accession number to the sequence that they were talking about. So basically, the researchers would have to come along, they'd have to deposit their sequence in a database. In return, they get a unique accession number, and then when they write the paper, they cite that accession number in the paper rather than typing out all the bases. And so this model has become, wasn't universally accepted at first. In fact, it was quite controversial, which seems odd now because it seems so obvious. And it's been extended to many other biological data types, protein structures being one of them. Yes, we now have many data types at the EBI. The core business is still DNA, proteins, protein structures. There are a lot of related data resources, many of them these more curated resources, on top. And actually, there's been an initiative recently at our institute to try and model this data and figure out which parts are related to what and how they cluster. And I don't expect you to read all the stations on this tube map of data, but it's just to illustrate that there are quite a lot of different types and they are related to each other. And this little blob here is where they put the literature, which I sort of fundamentally disagree with, being someone from the literature background. I really think it's not like an end terminus to some distant line. I think it's actually wrong to compare the literature with other data types. It's actually a sort of blanket form of data that touches all of those nodes. It's not an endpoint. So a bit more about the data at the EBI. I'm talking big data, thematic data. It's public. It's archive. We have an archival responsibility via many international collaborations. The latest, in terms of scale in bytes, there's apparently about 2 petabytes of data at the EBI right now, which scales to a sort of disk requirement of 7 petabytes. Once you add in the compute and the backup and things like that. And the majority of this is actually DNA. DNA, with all the resequencing and sequencing technologies that are emerging, is keeping us very busy figuring out how to store all this information. So here are the six main data types, and as you can see, the trend is just up. The only difference is the gradient. Nucleotides, genomes, proteins, protein families, gene expression experiments, and protein structures are some of our core resources. Okay, so that's the data I'm talking about linking to at this point. So what are we linking from? What are the literature databases? One that's already been mentioned is UK PubMed Central. I'll describe that in a minute. But when I came to the EBI a few years ago, there was already a database there of metadata called Site Explore. This has includes PubMed. It includes non-PubMed parts of Agricola, the agricultural database from the United States, and some patents, quite a few patents actually, 3 or 4 million from the European Patent Office. So about 26 million abstracts in total. There's a website, there are web services if you're interested in programmatic access. And we've enriched that with a citation network. Quite a large one, not quite as big as the ones of Elsevier and Thomson's, but we've used what we can get our hands on. Database links and some text mining. And just to give you an idea of the turnover, we're adding about just over a million records a year to that database. And more recently, we've come into the UK PubMed Federal UK PubMed Central project, which is full text. This is an entirely different matter. And the full text is largely kept as XML. We have some back content scanned as OCR, but the drive forward is XML in the same format according to the NLM DTD. So now the UK PubMed Central website contains both abstracts and full text, basically. A little bit about that project. We build UK PubMed Central in collaboration with the PubMed Central in the United States, and there's a node in Canada also. And it's been going since 2006. More recently, the EBI has led this project in collaboration with the British Library and the University of Manchester. And it's supported by 18 funders of biomedical research, led by the Wellcome Trust in the UK. And their total research spend is about £2 billion. And the bit that the sort of front-facing bit is the life science web repository of articles, but it also has a service by which you can submit manuscripts, effectively self-archiving by grant holders. It has a database of grant information which has about 18,000 PIs in it, which is about 50,000 grants. It has grant reporting and funder tools, and our current use is about 40,000 IP addresses a day. It's about 7,000 direct searches by people, but about 250,000 requests of data in total. So it's decent, but we're definitely like the little brother of PubMed USA. Just to give you an idea of what we've got, if you take the publication date of 2010, and you say, for argument's sake, the total number of articles published in 2010 in PubMed is 100% of the biomedical research article space. Then using that as 100%, we have about 18% of PubMed in PubMed Central. So 18% of life science research articles are in full text form. And of those, about 7% of PubMed are actually open access. So as you can see, there's a trend that's growing, but it's got a way to go before, you know, we have a full text open access PubMed. Okay, so that's the data literature I'm talking about. How do we make the connections? There's two ways, basically by links or by text mining. And there's probably other ways we could do, but that's what we're doing right now. The links are made by the author on submission of metadata to the primary databases, or by database curators in the case of the curated databases. And these links are very nice because they're done by human beings that are highly qualified to make the links. But so they're very high quality, but it's quite expensive, of course, and it's quite slow. The text mining approach is, of course, by algorithms that use vocabularies to find terms or relationships of interest. The good news about this is that you can apply it post-publication. But, of course, the quality is variable. That's the sort of payoff, but the throughput is extremely high. So we've actually mined the 2.2 million articles in UK PubMed Central for named entities. And there's absolutely no way you could have done that by employing people to do it in a scalable way. The good news is it can find things that the author overlooked, because it might not have been the focus of the paper at the time, but it might be someone else's interest to see a particular component of the full text in light of what they're interested in. So that's a good thing about it. But you have to be aware that it can lag behind the cutting edge, because it's only as good as the vocabulary that you've got. So if your vocabulary is very out of date, then you won't be tagging the most recent innovative terms. So we apply both these approaches. Here's a graph of our links from literature to databases. We link to proteins, nucleotides, OMIM, which is Online Mendelian Inheritance in Man, published by John Hopkins University, a big catalogue of genetic diseases and the genes that cause them. Chemicals, protein structures, we have some clinical review links. We link to protein databases that cluster protein families and protein-protein interaction databases, and there's many more. We're going to do gene expression experiments next, and I'm sure there's more that we could do. The two things in green are actually everything is at the EBI except for the two in green. We don't make those data, and there's no reason why we couldn't link out to other databases in the future. And in terms of scale, the big column on the left is the other proteins, and there's about. The scale is awful. It's a horrible slide, I'm sorry. But that's about 800,000 unique articles linked to proteins, ranging right down to the other end, which is the little piece of the pie at the bottom, is the protein-protein interaction database. That's about 5,000 articles. In terms of the text mining, we've mined six semantic types, gene or protein symbols, organism names, diseases, database accession numbers, chemicals, and GO terms. This is a gene ontology vocabulary terms, and there's quite a wide variety in terms of the number of the size of the vocabularies and the number of articles they touch, but the bottom line is there are millions of annotations amongst our articles, and most articles are touched by the text mining. We do this on a daily basis, so when we have a daily content ingest, we're doing this as part of our indexing processes. Okay, I'm going to give you a compelling case study now, to really show how when you link this structured data together with the literature and compute on those data, how useful it can be. And this is what I'm really interested in, actually, this kind of thing. Right, a little bit of biology. Do we have any biologists in the audience? Well, I'm very glad I made this slide in that case. So this is one representation of the tree of life. It's describing evolution in graphic form. So basically, evolution states that all forms of life evolved from a common ancestor, which you can see is the trunk of the tree. So therefore, on some level, all forms of life are related to some degree or other. And the closer you are on the tree, the more closely related you are. So this is why, for example, when we're looking for models of human disease, we use other mammals to model that on, because all the mice and rats and chimpanzees and dogs and humans are all up here. And you wouldn't want to model human disease necessarily on some slime down here. So however, you know, there are some genes that are conserved throughout evolution. These genes you'd find across the whole tree of life. And the more widely conserved they are, the more spread of species. If the spread of species you find them is very, very different, then the gene is much older in evolutionary terms. Recently occurring genes will occur just in these branches, but the very ancient, very important genes for life will have appeared down here. Okay, with that in mind, I want to tell you a story about a research experiment that happened quite a long time ago now, almost 20 years ago, in the early 90s. And a group in America were studying human colon cancer. And in the course of their studies, they identified a gene of interest that seemed to be causative for a particular kind of colon cancer. And so they isolated that gene, they sequenced it. And then because they have a nice sequence database that's publicly available and contains all the sequences from all the researchers in all the world, they searched that database using an algorithm called BLAST, and they got a hit. And this is what the output looks like when you make algorithms against that database. The top line here is the query sequence, which you probably can't see. Query is the human sequence. The subject is the hit, the E. coli sequence. And the line in the middle, which has got a few gaps but a few repeated letters, is where the similarities are. So as you can see, it's not like 100% similar. If you put a human sequence for this gene against another human sequence for this gene, you'd likely see a lot more similarity. But there is definitely similarity between the E. coli gene and the human gene, and often this similarity will be in functionally important areas of the gene. That's actually a protein sequence I've aligned here because it's a bit shorter. And where you see sequence similarities, you often see functional similarities, so you know that function's been conserved across evolution, so it must be important. So, okay, what the first thing they did was when they found this E. coli sequence, they looked at the record in the database, and as part of the metadata for that E. coli record, the researchers had added a link to a paper. And the paper described the role of that gene in E. coli, which was in DNA repair. So this sort of makes a lot of sense, actually, because as we know that cancer is a disease of when replication of cells goes bad. That's why they grow tumours and things like that. And so if you're defective in an enzyme that repairs your DNA, it can't be repaired properly, then you'd expect that to cause problems for cellular replication. And so this was a very, very nice example of how you, when you link the literature to the data, and then you can compute on that data how valuable it can be. Here's that article today, nearly 20 years on. This is the UK PubMed Central view of that article. And as you can see, this is the abstract only. This is only available in abstract form. We've applied some text mining to the abstract, and you can see we haven't done a bad job, actually. The bacterial gene is called MUTS. We've highlighted that in pink. We've highlighted the yeast homolog, also MSH2. We've highlighted terms like mismatch repair, and chromosome, human, E. coli, and so on, and also colon tumours. So we're hitting the spot, I think, with our text mining. We actually did miss one gene. I don't know if anyone can spot that. So it just shows the algorithms are not perfect. This one, I don't think you can see that here. With this, I think it's H, which means human, probably messed up our text mining. I don't think that is a commonly used parlance anymore. So I don't think it's in the vocabulary that we use, basically. Okay, so that was a very, very, landmark type article. It's been cited many hundreds of times since, and in UK PMC we do citation counts, as I mentioned earlier. So this, in our network, has been cited 849 times. And other networks will be have more. And as you can see, some of this little symbol here means that we've actually got some of these in full text in UK PMC. So things have moved forward in time. And if you look in that list of articles, you will find one of the citing articles is actually someone who has elucidated the protein structure of the MUTS gene. And in the article that they describe this, they also cite the accession number for PDBE, which is the protein structure database. And if you look at that structure, this is what it looks like. So this is a nice representation of the structure of MUTS. And it's very pretty and rainbow-like. It shows the charge and the different domains of the protein. And the nice thing about this particular structure of it is that it's actually solved two structures. It's got the protein, which is this big mass, but you can also see it on the left, clearly a DNA double helix. So you can see where the functional domain of importance is. It's right there where it's binding the DNA. Very important role for this protein. Because all the structures in PDBE are in a certain format, there are algorithms that have been developed to find similar structures, just as you can find similar sequences. And I don't expect you to read this, but there are quite a few now. There's quite a lot of redundancy. These are structures that are all highlighting different mutations. Looking at this one that I've highlighted down the bottom, I went and looked at the record for that in PDBE. That record is linked to the literature. Here's the paper it links to. The bad news for me about that at this conference, perhaps not what I'm back in, within my firewall, but I can't read the paper because it's at nature.com. And it's from the year 2000, so we've moved through time, but it's before many of the funder mandates, for example. I suspect this one being published by the NIH would have nowadays be actually available in UK PMC. But it's from 10 years ago, so it doesn't apply. However, keeping in mind the accession number of this record in PDBE, which was 1EWQ, which fortunately is reasonably unique, it doesn't always happen that way, we can find in our full text corpus a number of articles that cite that accession number. So this is great. So now I actually do have access to these full text articles that are talking about that very same structure, which is very important in science to have correct provenance of the materials that you're using. And I like this because we're actually talking about the homologs of this gene in tomatoes, as well as bacteria, other bacteria that have it, as well as humans. So we're now seeing the full evolutionary spread of this protein. I just clicked on the one at the top. It's in Nature Structural and Molecular Biology. And now this one was published, last year, 2011. So now we're 20 years on from the original discovery of this linked genes. And now the researchers now get to the point where they're looking at single molecule technologies to investigate how that repair mechanism works. And here's a very beautiful and complicated picture from that paper that we now have in UK PMC. So now I can look at it. You can look at this paper now if you like to. I think that's a really nice story because it really shows how, you know, the proper links aid scientific discovery, and also you see through time how things evolve. But this brings me on to one of my challenges for the future. As you can see, this figure is very pretty, but it's just a figure. The data behind the figure are not available. If you wanted to actually try and replot some of these plots, you'd be there with your ruler at a printout at your desk trying to read off from the graph. It would be much nicer, for example, if there was an Excel spreadsheet behind there that just had the data for you. Furthermore, there's a couple of references here to supplementary data files of different figures, apparently. What does this mean? So this is one of the trends of scientific publishing as we know it, is that it's becoming very data rich and lots of appended files, not just a paper product anymore. Okay, so of course one of the things we want to do is make our integration richer and deeper, and this will we can do our best here, but actually there are a lot of things impacting on that, and we'll have to collaborate quite heavily with many different types of people, I think, to do a good job. And in particular the area of vocabularies and vocabulary development, new technologies that are emerging that aid this kind of thing, and also the community need to help out a bit by being good citizens and depositing things where they should go, and perhaps even citizen science doing QA on automatically identified terms, and that's another possibility. I also think that there are roles. Thank you. clearly, the unstructured data sets are becoming more and more important. It's possible that world will also will emerge new thematic data sets where researchers find a particular data type of interest and somehow put it together into another, you know, maybe a thematic data set. And also, there might well be trends where you would want to spot unstructured data sets becoming more structured, and you might think, well, there might be at some point in time you might want to make that more formal and then put it into a structured data format for cross computation. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for the future for integration. Another of our major challenges in the life science, probably everywhere, it's not unusual, is it, is the data-driven science aspects of what we're doing. This is, actually maybe I should have a little quiz and guess the number of authors on this paper. I think the number of authors on this paper probably exceeds the original limit of what can be put into general, actually, in terms of the bytes. This is not unusual. There are many of these wider projects in life sciences these days that require cooperation across the world, many, many labs. Unfortunately, these articles don't really lend themselves to text mining. They're quite boring, actually, a lot of the time. The real richness of the data is actually in the data that they've generated and put in the databases. But they do elicit citations of the future, which do get into the biology and link back to this paper. They get cited quite highly. I think this one was only published a year or two ago, and it's already been cited 100 times, for example, which is quite high. Finally, we need to make solutions that make sense to scientists, to be honest. We have to kind of try and put these things in the context of their daily workflows. It's no good doing some brilliant thing if it's completely offline to what everybody is doing today. So an example of this is at the EBI, we're trying to improve our global site search and show the sort of skim the surface of the data that we have to show a sort of overview of what we've got for particular concepts. So here is the mute S gene again, and this is the genomic information. Actually, it shows the structure of the gene on the chromosome. It actually also lists that it now has over 4,000 known mutations in it, some of which will be of clinical importance. There's gene expression experiments, proteins, protein structure, and the literature. So you get special colour for some reason on the scheme. But you should be able to just click on these tabs and find out at a quite a high level what we've got on this gene. Finally, a merciless plug for the thing I spend quite a lot of time doing these days, which is UK PubMed Central. Quite soon, actually, later this year, we're going through a rebranding process to become Europe PubMed Central. And really, this is part of a move to become to operate on a model that's quite like the sequence databases, actually, and the structure databases and the gene expression databases, which is that this is an international collaboration where data is input locally, and then it's shared across the globe amongst those nodes. So basically, you can do things differently locally, but everyone's looking at the same data. And I very much like this model for the literature, also the open access literature, where the data is available in a number of places. The data is the same, but the applications can be different, and this will stimulate innovation by researchers and companies alike, I believe. So that's all I had to say. I think I would just... Thanks very much.